Well, good morning, Chair, Commissioners, and Director Unsworth. Appreciate you accommodating the schedule and allowing folks to present early. So I'm just going to just wanted to briefly introduce the project, and then I'll hand it over. But just say a few words from my perspective. This is a just an amazing research project for a number of reasons. One, it's as you'll see today, they've made a lot of progress on this incredibly important issue. So the science piece of it and the partnership piece of it, which you'll see, it's an incredible partnership, an international project. And I also think just my personal involvement in the project, I've learned a lot and have really appreciated working with Long Live the Kings and all the other partners. And so I think it's been a really good project for the department. So I'm really excited that these folks are here and able to present the project. And with that, I will hand it over to the folks here. And let me let them go through and introduce themselves, and then Michael can start the presentation.
Sure. I'm Michael Schmidt. I'm the program director for Long Live the Kings. I'm also the U.S. coordinator for the Salish Sea Marine Survival Project.
I'm Barry Berjikin. I'm with NOAA Fisheries at the Northwest Fisheries Science Center at the Manchester Laboratory.
I'm Paul Hershberger. I'm the station leader at the Merrillstone Marine Field Station with the U.S. Geological Survey.
I'm Ken Warheit. I'm the director for Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife Genetics Laboratory.
And I don't know that I'm actually Eric Netherland, and I'm in the Science Division Program with the department in the fish program.
All right, so I'm going to give you a brief overview of the project as a whole, and then we'll step down to the findings of with Steelhead, which Eric will start, and then these gentlemen will provide a briefing on specific components. Just a quick history on this project. This issue of declines in marine survival, which is the small to adult survival of fish, the when they leave their rivers basically to the time when they return as adults, isn't new. Actually, Dr. Mankin was working on this issue with Dr. Beamish up north from the Pacific Biological Station before he retired. And we got on this specific issue as an organization because we hosted a U.S.-Canada session at a Hatchery Wild Interactions Conference where most of the scientists involved said, well, we could discuss hatchery wild interactions, or we could discuss the big elephant in the room, which is why are fish seem to be dying in Puget Sound in the Strait of Georgia. And so from there, a recommendation came out to develop a program like we have now. So this is what we're calling a Salish Sea-wide anomaly, and why we're saying that is because if you look at, again, these are the small to adult survival trends of fish from the this is coho, chinook, and steelhead from Puget Sound in the Strait of Georgia versus the coast, that there were declining trends throughout the 80s into the 90s and into the 2000s. And on the coast, you see more general variability. There was a time period, if you see on the steelhead in the lower right, that's a good example. There's a strong open ocean effect on all of the fish populations in that late 80s period. But there has been a differential level of survival still in Puget Sound in the Strait of Georgia. These fish basically haven't seemed to bounce back. And also just to point out that they were surviving more so than coastal populations, at least for chinook and coho, than now. And now it's either at or less. So it's why was it so good in the past and not so good now? And for steelhead, is why is it so really, really bad now? And so there are other known changes in the Salish Sea. There's hake and cod and rockfish have either declined in numbers or in size. Same with herring and eulachin. That's another forage fish that used to come out of the Fraser in massive numbers, which doesn't now. Kelp is not as abundant as it was. And then that little guy in the bottom is a Neocalanus plumcris. It's a copepod that was dominant out of the Fraser, and which was a big food source. On the other side, we have more seals, more harbor porpoises, more pink salmon, a lot more jellies, as you've been seeing in the news lately, more people, and higher temperatures. And this year is a real extreme version of the higher temperatures perspective. But these are all things that we know. There's a lot of things that we don't know, and we don't have the dots connected to how this may be affecting fish, or at least the salmon and steelhead that we're looking at. So what did we do about it? So we worked with we along with the Kings worked with the Pacific Salmon Foundation. It's another nonprofit out of Vancouver to create a collaborative. And right now it includes about 150 participants across 40 groups. The budget for the research phase we're working on right now is it's $10 million on the U.S. and $10 million in Canada. And I'll show you the budget in a minute. And then this is a five-year research phase. And obviously we have those two countries involved, and we're asking one question, which is what are those factors driving the juvenile the survival of juvenile Chinook, coho, and steelhead in that marine environment? And why we think it's the juvenile phase is, one, because of the disparity in survival versus the coast, and other, there's evidence from many, many regions that early marine stage is very critical to the overall ocean survival of these fish. This is my NASCAR slide. It shows all the different groups, and it is a conglomerate, including federal, state, tribal, and academic folks, and other nonprofits, and private industry. There's different groups involved. So it's very big. And this is the fundraising status. Right now on the U.S. side, we've raised $5.5 million, and we're trying to reach our $10 million goal. On the Canadian side, they reached their $10 million goal in the spring, so they are beating us, which is not fun, but we'll get there. This was driven by two major sources of funds, at least for the U.S. side. Well, for both sides, it was the $5 million from the Southern Endowment Fund, which is associated with the Pacific Salmon Treaty, and they split that between U.S. and Canada, so each group got $2.5 million. And that's going to the research. And then $1.6 million has come through the Washington State Legislature to fund specifically the steelhead component of this work. And, again, it's been matched. This is just new money. There's at least a $10 million in match of in-kind effort by all the collaborators involved. And so what are the overall objectives of this? Well, you know, we're doing this research for a reason. We want to know what happened since the 1980s. Why have these fish seemed to have declined, at least their marine survival? And then also for locally, how do we take this information and improve adult return forecasting? So not only just for recovery, but for future management. How do we make our harvest forecasting better? So what are the primary hypotheses? So these are big, broad hypotheses, but the dominating one is that bottom-up processes that drive Chinook, coho, and forage fish prey availability have changed. So the food availability is not what it used to be, and fish aren't able to compensate. So it can be a combination of food and possibly limited diversity in the populations going out. They may not be able to adapt to the change in food supply. Top-down processes are contributing. More predators are making situation worse, targeting larger out-migrants like steelhead, resident salmon, and forage fish, larger age. And then other factors may be compounding this issue, be it disease, toxics, habitat degradation, et cetera. And then ultimately, the goal here is to find this out, but we've got to build back to what's driving these issues. We've got to know if it's a local issue, if it's something that you can do about, like water quality or hatchery management, predator management, et cetera? Or is it a regional effect that you have to adapt to, like climate change and the effects of that, or OA, or if it's just natural cycles that just have a different effect locally that we, again, have to adapt to? So this is the general framework of the research. There's a bottom-up research, again, focused on that bottom-up hypothesis, top-down research, which is predominantly focused on predation, but also includes disease and other top-down effects. And then there is the what we call trends analysis and modeling, which is the taking all of the data and merging it and building the story. And it looks really more like this. All of these areas are overlapping, but we do categorize them to, you know, for communications purposes, if anything. And a quick report on what the status is overall of or some highlights from the research. For that trends analysis and modeling, we've had task teams, international task teams, working on reviewing those smolt to adult survival rates, those marine survival rates, and refining them for the purposes of putting that information with ecological information and then trying to, again, tease out drivers with the existing data we have. And then also we had, up until this point, we've had a lot of information or have been building, we meaning the greater region, has been building a lot of information on the physical circulation patterns, et cetera, of the Salish Sea. But they have not built that up to what that means for the biological environment. So what we're trying to do is help build that physical biological connection. And then there are growth and survival studies underway. So one of the major components of this is looking at critical growth periods for the juveniles as they're migrating out through the marine environment and then trying to determine how that growth correlates with survival and where the pinch points are. And we have also used this large framework to create these decentralized monitoring networks. There was limited collection of zooplankton or the food for the fish in Puget Sound, highly limited in Puget Sound, and then somewhat limited in the Strait of Georgia. So there have been these citizen science groups up in the Strait of Georgia, and then we've used our large management network down here to create a Puget Sound-wide zooplankton monitoring program. And those programs are underway and are working, which is when you do big collaborative science efforts, all the folks worry about standardization, but we're getting there. And then on the top-down part, there's a soundwide contaminants assessment that is nearly complete. The draft is done, and this was led by Dr. Sandy O'Neill from DFW. And it was looking at contaminants in juvenile Chinook as they migrate through the system. And there was some new technology developed up in the Strait of Georgia with a gentleman that actually now works for DFW. But at the time, he was at UBC. It's a pit tag reader. It's the little tags that you put in fish, and you can put these little arrays to read them. It's a reader that actually fits on the top of a harbor seal's head and can count the number of fish consumed that have those tags, and they've deployed that type of technology to look at coho mortality up in the Strait of Georgia. And we're using a little bit different tech down here, which Barry will get into in a minute, but it is cool. And then, of course, the Puget Sound steelhead studies, which we'll get into right now.
Excuse me. On the zooplankton studies, mm-hmm. are we getting citizen science in that?
So we, because of the, yes, from the level of we have some nonprofits engaged. Yeah. Uh-huh. So there's Quiot, which is a nonprofit in the San Juan Islands, has taken on that role. And then the Hood Canal Salmon Enhancement Group or the Pacific Northwest Salmon Center, whichever they're going by right now, has also are starting this year. But we have a large co-management structure. So there are quite a few tribes that are engaged and have taken the role of collecting the zooplankton in their areas. Plus King County implemented a program, a long-term program they started last year, partially inspired by this effort.
So. Yeah, that's a great, once you get the protocols in place, for great citizen science avenue. But the RFEGs, again, mentioned that earlier, that would, like you're using one, but I think that would be a nice avenue as well, because most of those have trained biologists or fishery folks on staff.
Yep. Good. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Connie.
Is there any attempt to make a historical – I'm sorry.
That's all right.
Is there any attempt to make any kind of historical comparisons in places like Hood Canal in the zooplankton database? Because there is old information.
Yeah, that's good.
That's really quite detailed information on Daybob Bay, for example.
Yeah, so we Dr. Julie Keister, who's our zooplankton ecologist, our primary one for the Puget Sound side, one of the original efforts was to do that historic to present from the Daybob Bay collection. However, we've been going through the archives, and they're unfortunately not as organized as would be useful, and also the time periods don't overlap as well with the current collections. So we're trying to figure out how to adjust to that and whether or not we can still get something out of it.
Commissioner Carpenter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I'll take an attempt at expanding your workload a little bit. I guess I'd like some feedback on what's the reason that we're not studying sockeye, because it looks like it's a lot of a U.S.-Canada work, and also chum are having a heck of a time in Washington and in the Fraser. I was just wondering why those stocks were not included, or is that something later, or any thoughts on that?
Sure.
The one thing I'm going to talk about is a grave concern of mine is Lake Washington sockeye that are really in the tank.
Yeah, so I'll just start with the why on the other species. One is that from the data available, those other species didn't seem to follow the same patterns of declines, that the same patterns throughout the same year. So it wasn't apparent as apparent with those. And for example, Fraser sockeye have been quite erratic. There's been a general decline, but quite erratic compared to some of this. This is not to say too that there has been some interest in pushing this towards Fraser sockeye as well, because the Cohen Commission actually recommended doing some work on early marine mortality with sockeye as well. It just again, because of the similar patterns, this has been the focus. These three populations, Lake Washington sockeye, seem to have other issues they're contending with as well.
Lake's doing well, same stock.
Yes.
Lake Washington not.
Yeah, exactly. That's why it might be in the lake. Okay, you ready to?
Thank you.
Yep.
You want to hit that next one? How many?
Oops. Oh, hey, look, I did not finish. Sorry. Oh, just quickly, these are some visual examples of what's going on. So this is the growth and survival study on our side. This is led by Dr. Dave Beauchamp from UW and Dr. Josh Chamberlain from, well, actually he's not doctors, Josh Chamberlain from NOAA. But there's four rivers right now included in this, and it's the Nooksack, the Skagit, the Snohomish, and then the Nisqually. We're trying to build in the Green Duwamish as well to get an urban river. And then up north, the Canadians started in the Cowichan, and they're building out to the Qualicum, Puntledge, and then the Fraser, I think, are the other areas. But this is just basically collecting the fish as they move through the system in the small traps, then in the estuary, near shore, and the offshore using a purse seiner. And we actually chartered a Canadian seiner because he was awesome. And we went 2 years without a hitch. Go Canadians there and go international work, right? Okay, and this is what the actual sampling effort looks like now. So it's big, it's broad. The red dots are juvenile salmon collection, blue zooplankton, and yellow is just some of the buoys, but there's also physical monitoring via CTD. They're these little things you use to measure salinity and temperature, et cetera, that are being deployed with a lot of the zooplankton work. And then upgrades to the acoustic receiver arrays were done. There were acoustic receiver arrays deployed. When did it? It's like 2000 was the first.
It's been variable over time. Okay.
Yeah. So there was a network that it was initiated probably around 2000 locally to track fish as they're moving out of the Salish Sea. And what this project has done is help rebuild that system. And make it more uniform so you can track and isolate mortality mechanisms a little better. And this is being used on steelhead, as Barry will talk about, and then sockeye up north. So they are doing some work on sockeye in that system. Okay. Yeah, sure.
So I'm just going to introduce the steelhead piece quickly. So there's funding that comes for the steelhead research through the Washington legislature, and originally that came through the Puget Sound Partnership in a request last biennium, and then we worked with them to coordinate the research activities, and that's what we're reporting on now. And then we were successful in securing additional funding for this current biennium, so we have funding about $800,000 that we would be implementing in this current biennium, so not this summer, but next summer. And then we were able to do some current research just on kind of shoestring and end-of-the-year funds, so Barry's still, we're doing work this summer to continue it. We just can't do this full effort that we'll be able to do next year like we did last year. So just click through. So essentially, we're going to talk through these, not all the studies, but portions of these. And really, the main, you know, so we number one here, we wanted to assess correlations between survival and ecosystems. So that's a retrospective. The two is identify these locations and rate of timing and mortality. So we had previous acoustic tagging data, so we wanted to refine that. And then we also wanted to look at what role disease and toxics and contaminants were playing. In the bigger framework, what we were thinking is we really had no – we knew that fish were dying on their way out of Puget Sound for steelhead, and we knew that they were dying in a short amount of time from previous data. But there were some assumptions we wanted to test, and also we didn't know if they were if there was something that was happening in the freshwater that was somehow contributing to their swimming behavior. So we wanted to, this first last biennium, we wanted to focus our studies in on, you know, what's happening in the freshwater, what's contributing to their condition, and then when and where and how are they dying in Puget Sound or where. So that's what these studies will talk go through now. I think with that, I'll hand it over to Barry. Oh, there is?
Yeah, there's one in between. So Neela Kendall from DFW is not here, so I was going to do her part really quick. And it provides a little bit of context. So she went over the smolt adult survival rates for steelhead and then also abundance trends. And this was data that we were the steelhead work group was using to kind of isolate what factors to focus on, which may be drivers of mortality. And one of the signals that was seen and actually was mentioned earlier by a gentleman in the audience, that there's a basically a south to north gradient of mortality, it seems, and this is apparent in the abundance trends, which are here, and in survival trends, and then also in with smolt to adult data, and then also in early marine mortality data from the acoustic telemetry. But basically, this is just showing that South Sound seems to have a worse time than North Puget Sound, so this might suggest something about the amount of time you're spending in Puget Sound may lead to more mortality. And some of the other work that Neela did was this looking at different characteristics in the environment that where we have data to see if there are any long-term correlations. And there were correlations on the ocean side with upwelling and temperature, which is pretty consistent with salmon, that they do correlate with that. And then locally, there are correlations, positive correlations with herring, so more herring and more equals more steelhead, which may be a buffer prey effect. So if there are more herring around, it may supply food to predators that would be there. And if there are less, they may be focusing on fish. There are I forget if that's, I think, was it fewer steelhead with more hatchery fish? Yeah, it was an inverse relation, and then fewer steelhead with more harbor seals. Now it's you.
Got that one? Okay, yeah, I'll use this one here. So because of these trends in survival for steelhead and the north to south gradient that Michael mentioned, a number of researchers in the Puget Sound began looking at the fate of steelhead smolts as they migrated through Puget Sound with the advent and the miniaturization of these acoustic telemetry transmitters. So this little tag here, which is shown, actually should be down here in the belly, this thing emits an acoustic ping. And then you can set a receiver arrays on the seafloor. And as the fish swims by within a few hundred meters, it can detect that ping and give an individual identification. Then what you can do is go by with a boat, float over the top, and remotely download that receiver using a modem. So it allows for tracking the fate of individual fish in the marine environment. So a lot of researchers were doing this type of work in kind of one-off studies throughout Puget Sound. And that work was not put together as a kind of a solid experiment, and the data weren't really getting completely analyzed. So Megan Moore at the Manchester Laboratory, who I work with, has taken all of that data and put it into a common meta-analysis to look at the spatial and temporal patterns and the severity of mortality in Puget Sound in a paper that is just about to be published. And one of the common findings is that steelhead smolts migrate very rapidly through Puget Sound. So they're only spending about 2 weeks to get from, say, the main basin or south end of Puget Sound to the Pacific Ocean, which is different than most of the other salmon species. The other common finding is that survival is almost universally quite low. We get about a minimum survival estimate. Survival could be something higher than this, but it's typically about 20%. So a lot of the fish are disappearing in a very short period of time, which suggests predation as a potentially a primary proximate cause. The other thing that showed up in this analysis is that the basins behave differently. So the mortality patterns, say, in Hood Canal differ from those in the main basin of Puget Sound. So there were these receivers that were being put down and recovered, and it was never in a coordinated fashion. So as part of this project, we doubled down on that effort and established new receiver arrays. So reestablished the Admiralty Inlet Array with 13 receivers that are now down there for 5 to 6 years. We added 19 receivers across the central basin of Puget Sound that are down for 5 to 6 years, and then added 8 more to the south end of the Tacoma Narrows. And these were strategically placed to be equidistant from 2 of the primary study systems, the Nisqually and Green Rivers. We also established receiver arrays in the estuaries there. And then in 2014, with during the last funding cycle, we looked at these two populations. And as Eric mentioned, we need to separate out the freshwater effects. So what are the fish encountering? Their genetic makeup and the environment that they are experiencing before they hit the marine environment versus locations in Puget Sound where mortality is occurring. So these two things are confounded because each population enters at only one location. So we compared the Green River, which is a much more urbanized and developed watershed that has a strong hatchery steelhead influence, or has had at least, and compared that with the Nisqually River, which is much less developed and hasn't had any hatchery steelhead releases for about 30 years. So we have these contrasting environments and contrasting populations. And so in order to separate those two effects, we conducted a reciprocal transplant experiment where we took fish from the Green River and released them into the Green River and also into the Nisqually and then vice versa. A lot of findings from that initial work, and I'm just going to touch on a few of the kind of primary ones and then go into some more detail on some of the predator stuff. So we did confirm that the migration was very rapid, about 2 weeks. There was no surprise there. We also found that the survival of smolts coming out of the Green River, regardless of the population of origin, was higher than it was for fish coming out of the Nisqually River, regardless of whether they were from the Green River population or the Nisqually population. So we did not see any population effects, essentially freshwater effects. We didn't see any effect of that translocation, which was fortunate, otherwise the experiment wouldn't have worked. And we didn't see any effects of body size. So across the range of body sizes that we were looking at for steelhead, which is about so big to about so big, we weren't seeing any differential effects on survival. Release date was moderately important, and this was found in the retrospective analysis as well. It seems that the fish that are migrating out earlier are surviving better than those that are migrating even during the peak of the outmigration later on. And then I'll show you some data here that suggests that the highest mortality rates occur right after the fish are hitting the marine environment, and that longer migrations through Puget Sound are associated with higher mortality. So what I'm showing you here, again, are the receiver arrays. And this graph shows you the percent mortality per kilometer. So it's essentially an instantaneous mortality rate as a function of distance traveled. And if we look at the first migration segment, from the point of release to the river mouth, these green arrows here, equal distances, and from the Admiralty Inlet out to the west end of the Strait of Juan de Fuca, that's where we see the lowest mortality as a function of distance traveled, the lowest mortality rates. The highest mortality rates occur from the time the fish hit the estuary to the time they reach that first receiver array. And for the Nisqually population, or fish that had to migrate through the Nisqually River, there's additionally fairly high mortality that's occurring in this segment in the main basin of Puget Sound. And that additional mortality essentially accounts for that difference in survival between fish migrating from the Green and the Squally Rivers. So they have further to go, and they're experiencing mortality that whole distance. So the main point here is that, yeah, there's mortality occurring all the way along. It's stronger in some areas than other, and during some periods than other. We're gaining some other information from this type of tag technology. So this is the Nisqually River. This is about the I-5 bridge here. And so this is essentially the Nisqually River estuary. These different colors represent different telemetry receivers that were in place. As the fish are migrating out of the Nisqually River, and most of these estuaries, they only spend about 12 hours in the estuary on average. So they're moving through very rapidly, unlike Chinook or Coho salmon, chum salmon, excuse me. And the ones that survive spend very little time in the estuary. What we're seeing is that a handful of these tags are being retained in the estuary. They're moving back and forth with the tides over a period of about 4 to 5 days, sometimes even longer. And the fish that exhibit, or the tags that exhibit this pattern, are never seen again, never heard from again. So essentially, if you're a survivor, you move through rapidly. If you're moving back and forth with the tide, you're not heard from again. And this, to us, suggests that these tags may be carried by some sort of a predator that uses tidal movements to get up into the upper edges of the estuary and then move back down on the lower estuary. Pardon?
Been consumed by a predator
in the tag. So that's the hypothesis. So it gives us something then to look at more closely. Yeah.
Thank you. Predator. Any research done, any testing to try and determine what the predators is or are?
I'll give you your $20 now as I click to the next slide and say so.
Thanks. Well done.
Thank
well
you for teeing that up for me. I appreciate that.
Well done.
So Scott Pearson with Department of Fish and Wildlife, before we got started on this predator, about time we were getting started on the predator work, conducted a review of the potential predators on steelhead smolts in Puget Sound. And they went to their archives of all of the potential species that live in Puget Sound, the birds and mammals. And then they narrowed that list by looking at those that were abundant during the spring and summertime, further narrowed it by those that eat fish, and then fish of about the same size that steelhead are, and then further, if they were known to feed on salmon or steelhead, then that's a stronger indicator. And they actually came up with a very short list of potential predators that could consume large numbers of steelhead smolts, and this is the list right here. The top ones being harbor seals, cormorants, and Caspian terns. Harbor porpoise, which have increased in abundance substantially in Puget Sound in recent years, very little is known about their diets. We focused on harbor seals for the following reason. So harbor seal populations obviously have increased in the Salish Sea fairly dramatically since the Marine Mammal Protection Act went into effect. This is a graph from a Jeffries et al. Publication from Department of Fish and Wildlife that showed the increase and then probably some stabilization since about 2000 from recent surveys. This is the smolt to adult survival rates for Puget Sound stocks pulled from one of Michael's earlier slides that shows a decline in really low and stable smolt to adult survival rates. Now, they made me show this slide, so I'm going to. So this ties back to the discussion earlier, right? So here are two correlations, and apparently this is the total number of political action committees and people who died by falling out of a wheelchair. So the correlation does not equal causation, but there are a lot of things that are adding up here. Increases in harbor seals that eat fish about the same size as steelhead that are declining. Predation is a likely cause of mortality for steelhead. A lot of circumstantial information kind of coming together.
But there's a lot more cormorants than seals, a lot more cormorants than brant. And I know that cormorants are being taken out in various parts of the country now.
Cormorants in some areas, particularly on the coast and small coastal estuaries, has become a major issue. We have, I'm not going to certainly not rule out that cormorants are eating some steelhead. We didn't study that. And we have talked with the kind of bird experts, the Dan Robies and those folks that do this work in the Columbia River Basin, and they suggested that the cormorant colonies in Puget Sound are fairly small. They're located mostly towards the north, and they tend to migrate back down towards the Columbia River Basin about the time that steelhead smolts are leaving Puget Sound. So they're kind of an unlikely culprit in this case, but certainly not, couldn't rule it out. So in 2014, taking advantage of those acoustically tagged smolts that were being released into the Green and the Squally Rivers, we outfitted, so this is Steve Jeffries' group with Department of Fish and Wildlife, went to Central Puget Sound to the Orchard Rocks haul-out and the Blakely Rocks haul-out and tagged 5 harbor seals and 7 harbor seals up near Colvos Rocks near Admiralty Inlet. And they were tagged with a GPS transmitter so we could get accurate locations periodically when they would surface. And we added an acoustic telemetry receiver, a miniaturized receiver, that could detect the same tags that could be detected by those fixed arrays. So this black receiver here could detect those tags. And then those harbor seals were released. Months later, when they molted, that flotation pack would come off and float, and a VHF transmitter would identify where it was. And they were able to recover 11 of the 12 packs. So we got data back from all of those. And there's lots of data to pour over here, but I'm just going to kind of cut to the chase. So we had over 6,000 detections of 44 different steelhead tags that entered Puget Sound. Of about the 200 steelhead that entered Puget Sound, 44 were detected by harbor seals, about 6,000 detections of those 44 tags. And what this figure shows is that two tags were detected repeatedly at the Colvos Rocks haulout, indicating they were stationary at the haulout site. 6 of them at the Orchard Rocks haulout site, and 1 at the Blakely Rocks haulout site. These white dots here, I've just plotted the locations on a Google Earth kind of map here. Each of these indicates the location of those tag detections, and it's at least one. Sometimes one of these dots may represent a dozen or more detections. So we're getting some tags that are showing up at haulout sites. We also have tags that are showing up at other various locations, typically near shore locations around Puget Sound. We have other fine-scale data. This is data not from the estuaries, but from the haulout locations. So this is the tidal cycle is the line. Each of the different symbols represents the detection of a single tag. So here's one tag up here. This is a different steelhead tag here and a different steelhead tag here. This is detection by 3 different harbor seals on the same kind of tidal cycle over a 3 to 4 day period of time. And this occurred for 3 different tags and all of these at the Orchard Rocks haulout. What this indicates to us is that, and I should also mention that this time period is about the time it takes for a harbor seal to pass a pit tag from its gut when it's fed a pit tag, from studies done at the Vancouver Aquarium. So what this suggests to us is that these tags were being heard by the harbor seals that we instrumented, but were in the gut of another harbor seal, because the tags then disappeared and became stationary after that point. So then they were detected in one spot nearby. So this is kind of an initial look at this sort of thing. We need to combine this with broader spatial coverage, solid with some of the new DNA techniques, a SCAT analysis that would kind of confirm this type of work, so that we can get at an actual predation rate by harbor seals, and then also dig into some other aspects of fish condition, whether the fish are coming into the marine environment compromised in some way that may contribute to some of this mortality. So that's where I'm going to pass it off to Dr. Hershberger.
That's really interesting stuff. Yeah.
Okay, we also launched a fairly ambitious effort to assess the health and condition of steelhead smolts as they were out migrating through the rivers and through the watersheds. The general approach here was to look at five different watersheds, starting at the north of the Skagit, then the Snohomish and the Skyhomish system, Green Duwamish, over Tahuya over here in Hood Canal, and then the Nisqually in South Sound. And the idea was to follow the steelhead smolts as they outmigrated from the river out into the estuary and into the offshore areas adjacent to each watershed, and look at both contaminants and parasite levels in these fish. And I'll show you the contaminant data first. This project was led by Sandy O'Neill with the state. And what she found with PCBs was generally they were quite low. 1.4 to 2.2 times lower PCB levels than what they see in Chinooks at their respective areas. Even with these low levels, there were some high levels within the groups. 16.7 to 25% of South Sound samples exceeded adverse threshold levels for PCBs.
Was the source of that atmospheric?
Michael, do you have a...
The PCB did... Yeah. No, I mean, this source locations aren't confirmed on these. This is more just determining what's in the fish. And just something to note on this contaminants work is that the sample sizes were very small because they have to... the cost of running these analyses is very high, so they pooled a lot of samples. So when you see something like 16% of the fish, that's like 1 in 4 or something. So there's not as much of a concern on the PCB end.
Thank you.
Yeah. Also, she looked at PBDs, flame retardants, and they were a little bit higher, 1.1 to 3 times higher than Chinook that were sampled at the same locations. Among PBDEs, the highest levels that she found were down in the Nisqually region. 25% of central and south Puget Sound samples and 33% of the samples from the Nisqually River had levels that would be conducive to increased disease susceptibility based on the literature. Also, 33% of the samples from the Nisqually River estuary had levels that were comparable to altered thyroid production. Okay, what we were involved in directly, by we I mean myself, Martin Chen, and Bruce Stewart, was a parasite survey, really interested in looking at the burden and the load of Nanophyetus, which is a Digenean trematode, as steelhead migrated out through the watersheds. And again, we looked at each of these five watersheds, and the take-home message really is steelhead in the Skagit, the Snohomish, Skyhomish system, Skokomish system, and the Tahuya all had very low levels of Nanophyetus. We only saw a few positive fish, and they were in the adjacent offshore areas of these watersheds. The story was quite different in central Puget Sound and south Puget Sound. When we looked at the Green Duwamish River, there was a screw trap right here where this box is, and the prevalence of Nanophyetus there was about 13%. A few days later, when the fish migrated down to the estuary, the prevalence increased to about 87%. Then when they migrated to the adjacent offshore areas, the prevalence was 100%. So along with this increased prevalence, as the smolts were migrating down this watershed, the parasite load or the burden also increased. So we had very low parasite burden as the fish were higher up in the watershed, and it increased to much higher parasite loads down towards the estuary. The story was similar in the Nisqually, but not identical. In the Nisqually, the screw trap was right about here. And even at that our first sample farthest up the river, we had 97% of the fish that were positive for Nanophyetus at that particular site. Moved down to the estuary, and 100% of the fish were positive. So a very high prevalence at both locations in the Nisqually River. What was different in the Nisqually was we didn't see this gradient of parasite load as the fish moved down the river. The parasite load was extremely high, both at the screw trap in the river and farther down at the estuary. We were looking at about 1,700 to 2,500 parasites per fish, per posterior kidney, at both locations. These are extremely high loads that have been associated with mortality in other studies. We also did some histology and looked at some. We found some other parasites. There was a kidney Mixosporian, Sanguinicola, which is a blood fluke, and some other parasites that generally aren't accepted to cause direct mortality, but they're probably contributing factors as well. Based on the histological analysis, we did see a lot of gill inflammation and heart inflammation, especially from steelhead that were down from the central Puget Sound, the Green Duwamish, and then the Nisqually. And this inflammation, both in the gills and in the heart, was probably due to Nanophyetus. So nanophytatus in the literature has been demonstrated very well to cause decreased swimming performance, and also these levels of inflammation that we saw in the gills and in the heart also contribute to decreased swimming performance. Thank you.
So I'm going to continue the trend as we move from larger scale down to smaller scale and also moving from environmental factors to factors that are intrinsic to the fish themselves. So I'm going to introduce genetics as the next issue to explore here. I'm going to talk about a single study that we've done. It's a preliminary study. It was mostly just exploratory, and it's referred to as a genome-wide association study. And in this study, we're going to use genetics to look to see if we can tell the difference between looking at survivors versus non-survivors to see if individuals with different genetic makeup have a different propensity to survive or not survive. In general, genome-wide association studies ask this question: is there a significant correlation between genetic fingerprints and a phenotype? And what I mean by a phenotype, it could be behavior, life history, it could be survival. In most human genome-wide association studies, they look at entire populations and they're looking for a relationship between the prevalence of a certain disease and a genetic makeup. For this specific study, what we're looking at is we're going to look at steelhead smolt, their genotypes, their genetic fingerprints, if you will, and their fate. And here the fate is just going to be simply whether they survived or whether they died in Puget Sound. We're going to take advantage of the work that Barry talked about. We're going to use these acoustically tagged smolts. And I'm going to define mortality as that there was no detection of these fish in Puget Sound. And I have a slide and a map to show us specifically what I'm talking about there. Survival is all they have to do if they survive Puget Sound is be detected at the final acoustic array. They can be detected at other acoustic arrays, but if they're detected at the last acoustic array, then we know that they've been leaving Puget Sound. We're going to look at said genomic sequencing. The genetic fingerprint is going to consist of about 5,700 genetic markers. We can refer to them as genes. And I'm going to show an analysis with six different grouping factors. You've seen this sort of map before from Barry. These are the acoustic arrays down here, 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 and here. This is the final one at the Straits of Juan de Fuca. And we have genetic samples, and I want to credit Barry and his group for having the foresight to collect genetic samples for when they started these analyses back in 2006. So we were able to take advantage of a long-term data set. And we have samples from all these locations, Big Beef Creek, Duckabush, Hamahama, Dewato, and the Skokomish in Hood Canal, and then in two locations in Puget Sound, Green River and Nisqually. We have some 2008 samples from Green River, but the samples from Green River and Nisqually, that's the main focus of the study, were the ones that Barry talked about, the reciprocal translocation project. To make matters simpler for this initial analysis, I'm going to only examine samples that came from the Green River and Nisqually and Skokomish. There's a whole series of reasons for doing that, but this is the simplest way to approach this exploratory analysis. So I have a couple of slides that provide the results from the analysis. These are plots. They're known as QQ plots or quantile-quantile plots. Each one of those dots on each one of these plots represents one of those 5,700 genes. So on each one of these plots, there should be 5,700 dots. And if you want, you can count them. I'm not going to. The red line for this, we can consider this to be the expected or null hypothesis. And what I mean by that is that if you have no association, that is a random association, if you will, between a gene and this fate, survival versus not survival, mortality, if there's no association, if it's random, those dots are going to fit on that line. Any dot that is away from the line, any bit away from here or here, that means that there is a significant association. So if you have a dot, a gene, that is away from the line, that indicates that there is a significant association between that particular gene and survival versus mortality. And I've broken the analysis up into these six different separate analyses. This is fate only. I didn't use any other covariate with the analysis, and which means that I'm only looking at whether the fish survived or died. The second one is I'm looking at fate plus the year that they were out migrating. The third is fate plus their source location. Remember, I had three source locations, the Skokomish, Green, and Nisqually. This is fate and release location. Now, that differs from the source location because of Barry's experiment with a reciprocal translocation. So I took advantage of that and looked at both. And then I looked at year plus source and year plus release. I was not able to look at the larger analysis that would include fate, year, source, and release because I'm only dealing with roughly 100 samples here. And when I start breaking it down to that level of detail, we get zero in some of those cells, and you couldn't do a statistical analysis on that. As is, there's very little statistical power to determine anything definitively from these results because of the low sample size. So what are the results here? We have, for each one of these first five, fate, the year, source, release, and year plus source, we have a single gene that seemed to be associated with whether a fish survived or not. That gene is the same one for each one of those five plots. If you go to this last plot, you'll see three plus that one. But please notice the differences in the axis here. Okay? Now, these are log transform p-values, so any dot over here is going to be significant at 1 times 10 to the negative 5th. Okay? Take a look at these right here. This is going to be significant at 1 times 10 to the negative 150th. So these are highly significant. Now, without getting into any statistical details, these are somewhat biased low for the type of analysis I've done here. Nevertheless, these three right here are highly significantly associated with the primarily released location. This dot right down here is the same gene right over here, and it is significant as well. You just get it smashed down here because of the scale. So I have four candidates of genes that are associated with survival or mortality. As it relates to each one of these, three of them are highly associated with this release location. So I've just pulled out two of these plots. This one represents the one with the single one here, and these are these three right here. So who are these guys? Made the dot larger, and now I've numbered them. So this first one, which is this one plus this one, so what I do is I take these sequences and I subject them to a search through an NIH database. And these sequences I have are rather short sequences, so I get a lot of hits. I get a lot of positive results from the search of the NIH database. So I can't tell anything definitive, but these are highly suggestive in terms of what these genes' functions are. This first one right here, which was significant for all the analyses, is a gene, if you're interested, it's called homeobox or a Hox gene, and it's related with morphogenesis. This is during development. It has to do with how this individual is going to grow, and it has to do with the axial development, basically from anterior to posterior, and their fins. So this is possibly related to fin development and then potentially swim performance. I don't know that definitively. But again, this one was the one that was significant everywhere, so it may be associated with how well these fish swim. Number two is possibly immunological. Now, when I determine whether I have a significant hit during this search, I look at a thing called an E-value, and the E-value has to be above a certain level for me to consider it significant. The genes right here were slightly below that, but this one, the one that was most significant here, is possibly an immunological gene. And I've discovered this in the search, and it's an immunological gene that was in the database from a series of studies that are associated with Atlantic salmon. So it was in the right group. It looks right. This third one right here, there was no hit. I couldn't find any significant hit to a salmonid in there. Doesn't mean it doesn't have a function. It's just not in the database. I mean, we're breaking new ground here, so some of these things are not known. The functions aren't known yet. This last one had a total of, I think, 12 sequences that are associated with it. Most of those sequences, I think there were 7 of the 12, came back to an immunological gene. One of them came back to a morphogenesis gene, which is basically the same kind of gene as the one that was found over here. So in summary here is that we've had a strong association of survival and mortality as it relates to possibly how these fish have grown and how their fins have developed, and secondly, their ability to fight off infection. I don't know if it's related to the stuff that Paul was just talking about, but it's highly suggestive that it is. That's it.
Last slide.
I don't know why I get that. So we're just going to go through some conclusions, and then we'll talk about next steps. And this is just a summary. So, you know, as you've heard, we have worse from south to north. And then from the reciprocal transplant study suggests that marine mortality is the driver. So what we were talking about there is that we clearly the mortality is happening in marine water, and we know that it is not just like a hot spot, but it's happening along the way, and we get this strong pattern. But we're also seeing these factors emerge around disease prevalence and associated fish condition that we just talked about with these compromised gills and heart. And then smolts in some populations with particular genetic fingerprints, you know, they may be compromised, as Ken just talked through. So we just talked through that piece. And then The last piece is that predation is occurring and may include multiple predators. So one of the things that we're continuing to look at is that we know that we have had this interaction with seals, but as we talk more about other predators, you know, harbor porpoises have increased. So I don't, you know, I'm constantly trying to keep our field of view here wide as we go forward and focus. So I don't want to exclude things like harbor porpoise that have increased that we know can echolocate and kind of hone in on single species. But we also so we want to consider that, but we want to keep going forward. So for next steps, I don't think I have another slide here. So what we're, you know, we have the funding for this. This is just for the steelhead piece. We have the $800,000 that the legislature has appropriated, and we're right now in a process over the next 6 to 7, 8 weeks working through the results that we just heard, as well as the rest of the technical team, and coming up with a research plan. We already have a research plan, but we're going back and coming up with specific studies based on what we found, and it'll be focused on these particular items. And I'm not going to go into that now, but we'll develop that over the next 6 weeks, and then like we did last time, we'll circulate that widely and get a lot of opinions and comments from the scientific community, as well as some public experts as well. So with that, I think we're finished, and thank you for your time.
Any questions? Just okay. let me kick one off, just a quick one, because just going back to the cormorants, I know in the Great Lakes on perch populations, the cormorants went, you know, the numbers increased dramatically, and then U.S. Fish allowed the taking over the last decade of, you know, they culled the herd, so to speak, of cormorants, and the perch population has come back. So I'm sure you guys it's not analogous to what's here, but there was cause and effect from that.
It's a U.S. Fish and Wildlife
issue. Yeah. Okay.
That gave me another one.
let me just add something to this too. There's one thing we didn't talk about a little bit is the structure of the Marine Survival Project. On the U.S. side, we have both technical teams and work groups working in the field and on the science, but we also have a coordinating committee which builds up to the management level. So when these findings come in, folks can start considering what does it mean for management immediately, and then start thinking about how you get there. If and even, you know, looking at what advanced steps you have to take. So if we get to the point of confirming particular culprits in this, then it's easier to get to management than if we're waiting. So.
And it's also easier to take cormorants than seals.
Wow.
All right, good doctor.
Only one page, Connie.
I guess I'd aim this first one then at Barry, who I've known since he was almost a child. No, Dr. Berezekian, to what extent do you feel that you might have harbor seals locating on the radio tag itself and consuming these fish?
Yeah, so the tag emits an acoustic ping. This is the part I didn't tell you, just for brevity, but I'll give you the answer. They can hear the tags, and so we conducted a test as part of this study to determine whether the sound emitted by the tag would affect survival. And what we found is that there was no evidence to suggest that survival was any different between fish that carried tags that were silent as they migrated through the majority of the study period, and tags that were pinging continuously. We also found them to be at harbor seal haulouts in equal proportions to their release. So again, no difference in the behavior of those tags. The sample sizes were smaller than we would have liked, and it's something that we'll be continuing to work on in the next thing. But the indication from that study, we did them concurrently. Is there a major problem here with this tag technology? And can we conduct the study? We did them together, and fortunately, the answer was that, and it appears to be so far, that there's no effect.
Yeah, great. And this would be a question for Paul, who I've also known for many, many years. Nanophyetus is an interesting critter, and it occurs in areas, it's believed to occur in areas outside of the southern extent of the Pleistocene glaciations that occurred. So they occur in South Puget Sound, that's been known, but it looks to me like the distribution might be growing. It occurs in huge numbers in places like Grace Harbor, where it has been believed in the past to affect survival of fish out migrating from Grace Harbor. Has anybody done any post-release survival studies where you've taken fish with known levels, known loads of nanophyetus, and tested long-term survival in saltwater?
Yeah, you're one step ahead of us. That's the plan for next year. Barry and I would like to infect some fish with nano and release them and compare their survival to fish that don't have nano. We did a pilot this year where we had some fish that had chronic nano infections from the Seuss Creek hatchery, and they'd been infected for about 3 or 4 months with sort of chronic high-level infections. We put them straight into salt water, and they didn't die. And that's not very surprising because after the first 2 or 3 day period of the nano, the bug nanophyetus essentially swims through the water and strikes on a fish and burrows in through the tissues. And during the first 1 to 3 days of that burrowing phase is really the most pathogenic portion of the life cycle for the parasite. Once the parasite gets through that phase, it becomes chronic, and the host sort of encapsulates it, and it's no longer causing that much damage. So those are the fish that we used in our pilot study this year, the ones that had been encapsulated, and they were through the critical period. Next year, we're going to do it with the critical phase.
Good. Great.
Does it kill the host or just weaken the host?
It can do both. Yeah, with high loads, it can kill them directly.
Yeah. Dick Beamish has done some work looking at some of the physiological measures of fish as they enter and go into their third and fourth month at sea. And he's found that insulin-like growth factor is related to a critical size associated with these fish. Is anybody looking at some of these physiological measures like IGF-1?
Yeah, sure. So Brian Beckman from NOAA has been working across the border on both sides, and actually all the way up to Alaska he gets around, doing the IGF-1 analysis. He's been doing a bit. I think he continues to do it up north in the Strait of Georgia. We have Josh Chamberlain doing that for North Puget Sound here, so we are looking at that, building that as an index.
So you're ahead of me on everything so far.
Yes, sir.
I have one other question then. How do you explain the increase in Columbia River stocks of salmon while those in Puget Sound are declining?
It sounds like he's giving you a final, you know. Like,
that's a rhetorical question, right? We're answering your question right now. That's what we're doing. Yeah,
I know. Thank you.
Yeah. A dissertation defense is what you're doing.
No, this is an amazing study from my point of view. I think you're way ahead of the curve, and you should be complimented on all the things to bring together a diverse group of interests in the form of the people that you've got associated with it is terrific. And again, I think that it's a unique group. It's very broad. And Jim is one of the people who has really supported you very, very well on these studies, and he needs to be complimented on this as well. But anyway, congratulations. We await your final results. This is an age-old question. This is a question that people have been asking about for, you know, like 30 and 40 years. I first started listening to people talk about this back in the 60s. And really, until this group has been put together looking at these aspects and with the tools that you now have, I think you're going to get to some of these answers here. Again, congratulations. This is great.
Mr. Keene?
This was on the genetic side of it. Maybe I missed this. Were the tag fish both hatchery and wild? And if so, is there a correlation between the what you showed in the genetics of the morphology and the immunized or the immune system? Is there correlations there or relationships? So
Barry can talk directly about what fish were tagged. I can speak specifically about what this analysis was based on, and for the purpose of simplicity, I removed any hatchery fish that were designated as such. So these were fish that would have an adipose, an intact adipose fin. So can't speak to whether they are of hatchery lineage or not, but all these fish were born in the gravel.
Yes.
I want to congratulate you, too. That was a terrific presentation. I think you took a lot of very complicated, multifaceted information and really reduced it down to the essence. And that's always a terrific challenge for scientists who are so expert in statistics and various other aspects of this that the general public has a hard time with. So congratulations for that side of it. The graphics were really quite nice, too.
And it proves one last thing, that interagency cooperation is not a myth.
No, that's right. For sure. Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
We'll look forward to round two.